Now, detonate the reality bomb!
I will build a great, great wall.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The truth is out there.
The military-industrial complex.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know.
Change has come to America.
Catapult of propaganda.
From a secure location on top of the ridge in the heart of the beautiful Missouri Ozarks, this is a view from the bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
We may be living in the last days, but the apostles living 2,000 years ago thought so too. So, are we correct in a futurist interpretation of Bible prophecy? Welcome to Skywatch TV, a special broadcast for Thursday, March 2nd, 2017. I'm Derek Gilbert. Joining me via Skype from La La Land.
Where there is not much sunlight.
Ah.
Get it?
That's
versus gotcha. Moonlight.
Gotcha, gotcha. He is the award-winning author, the award-winning screenwriter of the film To End All Wars, and the author of several series of fiction that we recommend because there is biblical truth contained in them. Although, as we're finding out in recent days, we all within the body of Christ have different interpretations sometimes of what exactly that means. The author of the Chronicles of Nephilim series, Chronicles of the Watchers series, and a brand new series. His first novel is titled Tyrant, Rise of the Beast, Chronicles of the Apocalypse. We welcome Brian Gadawa to Skywatch TV. Brian, good to see you this morning.
Great to see you again too, Derek.
The novel, Tyrant, Rise of the Beast, you're dealing with prophetic topic here, but unlike most of us who will write about the end times as a future event and write from a nonfiction perspective, you're writing in a fictional setting and with a slightly different perspective. Describe the novel.
Yeah, Tyrant Rise of the Beast, which really just came out this month, is kind of the culmination of, you know, well over, I don't know, maybe 15 or more years of me studying the issue of prophecy and such. And yeah, you're right. To give it away right up front to the Skywatch viewers, it's definitely a minority viewpoint called preterism, but it's within the pale of orthodoxy. Many godly theologians and scholars throughout the years have argued for preterism. So it's not the usual viewpoint that you guys are going to hear on Skywatch. And I'm a fan of you guys and a fan of Derek and Josh. So we have had a lot of interaction over the last year or so, a little bit about this kind of issue. Left Behind, This Is Not. Mm. And I do realize, you know, there's actually a big market for writing fictional novels based on interpreting the Book of Revelation because, you know, let's face it, it's fantastic. It's very fascinating. And you know, sci-fi speculative storytelling is very popular and very fascinating and interesting. So there are already a lot of novels out there with more of the futuristic scenario, which is what makes mine so unique and different is I'm writing about the origin of the Book of Revelation mm-hmm. when the Apostle John wrote it in the first century. And yeah, I do have a different interpretation that I apply most of it to that time period. But there is a context that I think anyone who loves the Book of Revelation the context in which the book was written, I think it's a very informative and historical help to understanding the meaning of the symbolism when you understand a lot of the surrounding, things that were going on at the time, like during, Nero's reign and
cultural
such.
References that the writers of the epistles would have understood and certainly that John would have understood.
Yeah. Take, for instance, the seven churches, you know, and I mean, of course, you know, there's many interpretations of all these different things, but there's certainly plenty of scholars argue that no matter what you interpret, there is, you know, the seven churches are still rooted in some kind of historical reality. Because, I mean, you know, as I believe, John was writing to actual churches and we have the trail of the churches. The letters follow a circular pattern around Asia Minor where they traveled itinerant preachers and such. So nevertheless, you know, a lot of what John is writing to these churches was very relevant in that time period. And it gives you some insight into the demonic evil as well as where the Christian church was at that time.
Mm. Now, the term preterism is something that many viewers may not be familiar with. Could define that versus preterism versus futurism.
Yeah, the word preterism is basically a Latin word that means in the past. And the basic notion is that it's the belief that prophecies have been fulfilled in the past, not in the future. Now, be careful when you use that term, because there's all different kinds of preterism. There are some people who believe that all the prophecies were fulfilled in the past, even the return of Christ and the resurrection, and that's called full preterism. I'm not in that camp. That's a little too extreme for me. But on the other side, we have to realize that there's a sense in which everyone is preterist, in the sense that all Christians believe that there are some prophecies that have been fulfilled in the past, right? Like the messianic prophecies, of course, right? Mm-hmm. Those have been fulfilled in the past. So there's a sense in which it's a continuum of what prophecies were already fulfilled and what have yet to be fulfilled. But when you use the term preterism, that's my viewpoint. What I'm basically saying is a lot or most of the book of Revelation and a lot of the prophecies that many people nowadays think are in our future have actually been fulfilled in the past. Hmm. And that some people think that's heresy. In fact, I used to think it was. And it's certainly controversial. But circling back to the book, Tyrant, Rise of the Beast, I'm writing about the first century when Nero started the persecutions. And there are different theories about when the book of Revelation was written. Many believe it was written in the time of Domitian, but there are also scholars who argue that it was written in the time of Nero before 70 AD. And the reason why this is really important is because understanding the Neronic persecutions of the Christian church and where that led to the Jewish revolt as well in 66 AD, which ultimately culminated in the Roman armies coming to Jerusalem, coming to Israel, and conquering Israel, destroying the holy city and destroying the holy temple, which, of course, still lays bare to this day. This event is a seminal event in my viewpoint in the book, in the series. It's going to be a trilogy, but also in the preterist view, because it's a very important event that a lot of Christians don't know about that basically embodies the final historical end of the old covenant, the end of the age. That's what we see the end of the age as, is the end of the old covenant era, with the final consummation of the new covenant entering into history. Yes, it began at Christ's death and resurrection, but it was consummated at the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, because that was the final destruction of the earthly elements of the old covenant. Mm. That the spiritual elements were done away with in Christ, a generation earlier. That's the kind of the basic big picture, you know. But my goal in writing the book was, no matter what end times belief you have, you can still really enjoy the story, because I wanted to make it historically accurate in that time period. And mm-hmm. Think about it. This is we know a lot about the book of Acts, but there's a lot that we don't know from the book of Acts to that, you know, onward or till, you know, I don't know, the Middle Ages. A lot of times we don't know a lot about that time period.
Right.
And this event is very significant. You know, many Bible researchers and studiers will know about Josephus, the famous Jewish historian. And he's one of the only extensive writers on the topic of the fall of Jerusalem and the temple in AD 70 under the Roman armies. So no matter what view you have, it still happened in history, and it's a fascinating, truly fascinating story with, wars, battles, etc. But what I wanted to do is I wanted to bring in the supernatural worldview that we see in Revelation. For those who've read my previous series, Chronicles of the Nephilim, I was kind of following the divine council paradigm of Michael Heiser and the Watchers and trying to integrate that with Nephilim and how that all played out through the Old Testament and up into the New. And now in this series, I think that the book of Revelation is the most supernatural book in the New Testament, you know, with all these amazing demonic and angelic things going on. And I wanted to show what would it be like for that. What would that look like behind the scenes as well, while the apostles are basically being martyred, the church is being attacked, Nero is the emperor, And the Jews are also starting to rise up against Rome. So it's this fascinating picture. And that was sort of my goal. Yes, there's a definite viewpoint of prophecy and how it plays out in the first century. But I still I love the history of it. And I think anybody will be able to appreciate that.
Well, that's one of the things I like about the book. And you mentioned Dr. Michael Heiser. He's been very influential on my worldview as well. I know Josh here would agree. And similar to the fiction of Dr. Heiser in his novels, which he refers to as faction, which is based on history, you're using a lot of footnotes in this novel. I'm only up to the 10th chapter, and I think I just read footnote number 120. But what I thought was really interesting is that when I'm going to these footnotes, I'm having to rabbit trail, and that's why it's taking me longer to read. Because, for example, the heresy of the Colossians, and this concept that you bring into the novel through a rabbi who's leading a synagogue there, who engages in something called Merkaba, which is a type of mysticism. I didn't know anything about this, and yet you footnote it and show Bible scholars who say this may have. This may be the source of the reference in Paul's letter to the worship of angels and so forth. Talk a little bit about that. Some of the cultural or social references that you incorporate into the novel Tyrant that we probably don't know.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, look, the Chronicles of Nephilim series, one of the things that made it so popular was so much of what I was writing was unique, new, fresh, and many Christians I was worried would be freaked out by it. You know, giants, watchers, come on, really? Now, obviously not the Skywatch crowd. You guys are familiar. But there's many who wouldn't in the evangelical world. And I was thinking, you know, I come from a, you know, it's like, you know, you got to be careful. Don't play fast and loose with the Bible, right? So I had written appendices on each of the novels to explain the biblical and historical research because I knew it was so wild people would be questioning it. Well, it turned out a lot of Christians love that stuff. They loved it as much as the novel. So now imagine I'm going to write about the Apostle John, the Book of Revelation, a lot of controversy, you know, and there's a lot of debate on it, right? So I knew that this crowd who already loves research, if I write a novel, and by the way, I admit I know footnotes in a novel is anathema. You know, it's
I want entertainment. Don't make me think.
Exactly, and also, you know, it's just if you can't tell a story well enough, then why are you bothering with footnotes? I agree with all that. The only reason why I put footnotes in because this particular issue of Bible prophecy and all this stuff. Again, people are so committed to their views. I know that they're going to read this and they're going to have a lot of questions. Where did he get that? Is he making that up? And because they tend to love research, I said, well, I'll just provide the research for them. I could have just slapped it all at the end, but I figured, no, these are the kind of people who they'll probably read through and they'll go back again and they'll say, I want to see exactly where he got that. And so I actually footnoted it by paragraphs, mostly. And so that's for those people who do want to go into it more depth, but you really don't have to. You can skip over the footnotes and go back later if you want.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff in there. Now, the one issue that I always thought was a strong argument against a preterist or even partial preterist view of prophecy is that the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 by the legions under Titus was such a catastrophic and traumatic event in the national history or the ethnic history of the Jews that it certainly would have been included in the Bible. I mean, you know, somewhere in there, if it were a past event. Now, having said that, most scholars will place the authorship of the Book of Revelation somewhere in the 90s in John's old age. How do you address that? I mean, how do adherents of the partial preterist view account for that?
Well, first of all, you know, I found even in researching and trying to write this book, it's amazing how little we actually do know about a lot of things, even about the apostles. Where did they die?
Yeah.
You know, did Peter really die in Rome? Yeah. Was Peter ever really in Rome?
Did Paul ever make it to Spain? Yeah. Things like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Did he make it? And of course, we at the end of the day, we don't know. So I did my best to find out things. And I, you know, quite frankly, there's a lot of, you know, you might call them legends or traditions, let's put it that way, traditions in Christian history, with things like, you know, the Apostle John was boiled in oil and he survived. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's very questionable or just, you know, we don't really know. But I wanted to use a lot of what is in the tradition and incorporate that in because, you know, I respect the tradition and it may not, you know, maybe Peter wasn't crucified upside down, but that's a tradition and it has, you know, it has some legitimacy to it. And so I tried to incorporate all that material into there. But in the course of that, that's where I really discovered, like, look, you know, we got to do our best and figure out, you know, what evidence supports our views. There's a wonderful book on my website, Godawa.com. Go to the Chronicles of the Apocalypse section, and I provide scholarship for scholarly articles as well as free books that are online that you can get. And the classic book that explains, that makes the argument for the early date of Revelation is Before Jerusalem Fell by Ken Gentry. And if you're going to interact with the issue, you have to interact with that book. And many people already have, but he makes the argument that you know, the strongest, you know, notion for Revelation being written before the fall would be that there would be some kind of reference to it after the fact, because that's very strong. You know, they do that about the resurrection, right, in the Gospels and stuff. But you're right. There, nevertheless, there's most scholarship actually argues it was written in the time of Domitian. So, you know, there are those issues. But at the end of the day, if we're really honest, if you read enough of the scholarship, you have to say there are good arguments on both sides. And you know, you're going to have to commit to what you think are the best. But you also have to be open-minded, which includes myself. If it was written after AD 70, that Book of Revelation was written after AD 70, that will make that would be a strong argument against my system. And I have no problem with having a falsifiable belief system. The problem is if you have a system that you keep changing and you can never falsify it, well, then how can you ever prove it's right? And and that would be my reverse challenge.
Yeah, yeah. And we've run across a few of those here in recent days. Well, Brian, we tell viewers that there will be an extended version of this interview. We're going to continue on with sort of the post-interview interview on my personal podcast called A View from the Bunker. You'll find the audio version at vftb.net. The video version will be posted at my personal YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. That will be going up in a couple of weeks as we're holding a once-a-week schedule on that podcast. But wanted to give you a taste of this. It's a book that entertains. You get to see... And I appreciate the fact that much of the dialogue that you put in the mouths of the apostles, like Peter, Paul, and John, is taken directly from their epistles and from the Book of Acts. So while there's some creative license there, it's not straying way off the reservation. And I also think it's cool, you know, that one of the lead characters in the novel is Apollyon, who certainly is going to play a key role in the end times as well. But we'll talk about, in the extended version of the interview, Matthew 24, and how the partial preterist view addresses the abomination of desolation and other things that futurists will interpret as future events. Brian Godawa, award-winning Hollywood screenwriter, the movie that he won the award for, To End All Wars, with Kiefer Sutherland and Robert Carlyle, both excellent actors, but also some fiction that you'll find at his website that we highly recommend because they explain the Divine Council worldview and the fact that we're in the middle of a spiritual war with literal supernatural entities who want to kill you and everyone you love. Welcome to the extended version of the interview with Brian Godawa as we continue now on A View from the Bunker. Kind of nice being able to let, you know, dovetail these two things. And now since the podcast, I can loosen my tie since we don't have to worry about that anymore.
Can we talk a little bit about the, like you brought it up and I really didn't get into it, about the... You know, writing about the characters of the apostles and stuff like that,
That's something that it could be a challenge, I think, for anyone who's trying to write fiction, especially from that era. For example, my dad, one of his favorite books was a novel years ago about Luke, Dear and Gloria, something physician.
Yeah,
and I can't remember the name of the author or the name of the book, and it's somewhere in the boxes of books that I inherited from my father, and I'll have to dig that out one of these days. But how do you go about writing characters who are, you know, the apostles? I mean, their words are attested and been preserved for us for a couple thousand years. How do you take those and then fictionalize their actions without being tempted to stray a little too far.
Yeah, well, one of the things is I don't make them the main characters. My main characters are three characters in the story. I'll tell you what that is in a second. But yeah, I had a lot of trepidation because I have such respect for them, so much so that, like you mentioned earlier, I did try to – a lot of the things that they did say, I did try to take it from their letters. Not because I'm a King James literalist, you know, and you've got to quote the Bible exactly, you know, none of that kind of stuff. But it kind of comes from a similar space, you know, in that, well, look, I want to show that I'm not just willy-nilly making up whatever I want it to be. I'm rooting it in what they wrote and said. And so using that terminology, I know people are familiar with the Bible are going to recognize the language or recognize, oh, hey, he's quoting from 2 Peter or something like that. So my goal was more to ring true to what we do know about them as much as I can so that it, you know, it rings true. Mm-hmm. But here's the interesting thing. So but the way you do that is, my story, and we never actually on the show, we didn't say what the story is about. So let me tell you now. It's basically the story of three people, one a Jew, a Christian, and a Roman. And basically the main protagonist is a male physician named
Alexander. Uh-oh.
Yes, thanks. Alexander, and he's a Jewish physician, and he's a Hellenist Jew in Rome. And so he works with the sick and poor, but he also has to work for the Romans because, you know, they make you do that, you know, after they have battles and stuff like that. And his overlord is a praetorian, a prefect, whose name is Severus. And he's a Roman, hardcore Roman. And, you know, he's not a nice guy, but he's not evil either. He's sort of like harsh and, but, anyway, Severus, wait, let me get this right. So Alexander is working with the poor and then the great fire happens. And then of course, everyone's wondering who did it. Nero blames the Christians. Again, that's another Christian tradition that many people argue against these days, but I think it's still got a strong backing to it. But Nero blamed the Christians, and in order to divert attention. And some people believe that he deliberately did it so that he could rebuild the city, kind of like, you know, fundamentally transforming America, transforming Rome. And some people believe, no, it wasn't. It was just convenient, you know. And I think there's good arguments on both sides. So I try to bring out both sides in the story and not really explain it fully.
Crisis go to waste, in other words. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Anyway, so without blabbering on too long, basically what happens is, so Nero hears about these Christians and he blames it on him and he goes, you know, go find evidence for it, you know. And in the course of finding evidence, Severus is commissioned to do so. He discovers that there, you know, there's this, you know, these Christians have been talking about, you know, God's going to come judge with fire, you know. So, yeah, it's blaming on them. Then a couple of years later, or a short time later, this letter starts surfacing around the Christians. They start persecuting the Christians, enslaving them, and they Severus gets a servant who is a female Christian who was the heiress of a shipping magnate in Rome. So she's this strong Christian who actually really resents the Romans and the Jews for what they did to her parents and all this stuff. So she's got her own issues, and they force her to go along with them and help them. And she tries to you know, dissuade them and stuff. But nevertheless, what happens then is Nero finds out about this letter that's circulating that's been cut up into pieces, and it's supposedly a seditious letter against the empire. And of course, it's the letter of Revelation. Ah. So then he commissions Severus and his Jew to, with their Christian servant in tow, go find out who's writing this letter, where it is. He doesn't know it comes from John because they don't have all of it, right? And he goes around Asia Minor and stuff, tracking down who wrote this letter, and if it's a messianic pretender, kill him, and all this kind of stuff. So the context of the story is a sort of a Da Vinci Code mystery. You know, what is this subversive literature, and what is it really saying? Because they don't really know, because mm-hmm. they're Romans, right? And so that's going to give me the way to, as they're reading the letter and trying to figure out what means what, that gives me an opportunity to explain things in the course of an action-packed adventure, because these people are going to Asia Minor to find out, And of course, Asia Minor is where the seven churches were, and they're loaded with demonic activity. And that's where I bring in the spiritual side of things.
Mm-hmm.
But lastly, then, the watcher element, the gods of the nations. That's the paradigm I've been operating under. And as you mentioned, Apollyon is the Satan character. And I believe that Apollyon is Satan. There's a lot of arguments for that. It's another word for Satan, just like Belial or Mastema or, you know, Nakash, these different names that Satan takes. So I'm operating under that principle. But nevertheless, he's the Satan character who's going around and trying to accomplish his purpose in fighting against the kingdom of God. And in fact, he's a lot of the instigator behind the persecution of the Christians. And I bring back the paradigm of the watchers of the nations related to, if Satan is the watcher of Rome and Rome is the empire over the world, then Satan is the lead watcher, so to speak, and all the other gods of the different nations under Rome are then sort of subject to him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the paradigm I'm operating under.
Hmm.
And that will come to play as the series works out.
No, it's fascinating stuff. And the workings of the spirit realm, because with our natural senses, we only have a limited amount of vision into that realm. One of the things that Sharon and I did with the series that we started, which I think we're going to wind up re-releasing now, we were writing in the same fictional universe, but writing independently of one another, sharing some characters back and forth. We made clear that the spirit realm isn't all on the same side, that while you may have a watcher who's over Rome, the watcher who's in charge of Persia might not want to go along with the plan, or Parthia, or whoever. How do you interpret that, and where do you draw your source material for trying to figure out what the motives are of these watcher class angels and their demonic cohorts?
Yeah, no, that's a good question, because that's what I struggle with through the whole Chronicles of the Nephilim series, which is, you know, we tend to have this. I don't know about you, but I think in a lot of Christians, I know I did. We tend to have this picture of like the evil world is all unified. You
right.
know,
Satan and his minions. Right.
Yeah, exactly. But when I was writing Chronicles of Nephilim, and it goes over into the Chronicles of the Apocalypse as well, it's like, well, yeah, they would all have the same goal of being against God. But if they're personal beings, as I believe they are, they're not robots. They're not puppets. You know what I mean? If that's the case, then even if they are unified in the big picture, why wouldn't they be like every other evil being in the universe that we know of, whether it's from mafia to gangsters? They're going to have their own goals and their own, you know,
ambitions,
exactly. And so I'm actually going to bring that into the Apocalypse as well. But that was – look, my motive was just sort of realistic thinking about – our assumptions, because really, let's face it, there's really not much revealed about the machinations of the spiritual world. But then those things that we do see occur, like, you know, as you know, Job 1 and 2 and
1 Kings 22.
Yeah, 1 Kings 22. Thank you. But also Daniel, right? And in Daniel, like you mentioned, you know, talks about the different kings of Persia. And here the notion is this, you know, and this is the notion that I know you're familiar with as well, which is the ancient notion, the ancient biblical notion is that there are gods or there are sons of God, whatever you want to call them, watchers who are authorities over the different Gentile nations, and they're wicked. And so consequently, but also the principle, which goes into the New Testament as well, principalities and powers, what Paul writes about how the real source of authority, the real spiritual, the real evil is not so much the world we live in, but the authorities behind that.
Right.
Because they believed that whenever there was earthly historical events going on, there was also spiritual events behind it, so that the earthly authorities had spiritual authorities behind them, and they were linked in some way. How? We don't know exactly, but there's a commonality. There's a link there. So when there was a battle going on, for instance, a literal physical battle on earth, like in Judges, it talks about you know, a battle there in the stars from
right. Sisera, you know, and Barak, who led the
exactly.
the angels fought the stars in their courses, right?
Exactly, because they believe, and of course, we know that the stars are basically equivalent to angels
right.
of divine beings in their mindset. So there's a unity going on there between heaven and earth. On earth, it is as it is in heaven. And so that's a paradigm that I bring into Chronicles of the Apocalypse as well. And how does that all play out? You know, you'll have to get the books. But anyway.
Well, that's the whole point of the interview here. I was gonna throw in an aside showing just how clever I am that I learned something, but I'll pass on that. This is the focus on your book. Matthew 24, you put out a companion e-book along with Tyrant, Rise of the Beast, that focuses on Matthew 24, which is, of course, a chapter that many futurists will look at and see as elements of the end times fulfillment of the prophecy. For example, many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, leading many astray. Wars and rumors of wars, earthquakes in diverse places. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, famines and earthquakes. And these are the beginnings of birth pangs. They will deliver you up to tribulation, put you to death. You'll be hated by all the nations for my name's sake. Many will fall away. Many false prophets will arise and lead many astray, et cetera, et cetera. When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel, standing in the holy place, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. How are those events, the events of Matthew 24, interpreted through a partial preterist lens?
Yeah, the partial preterist basically believes that Matthew 23 and 24 really were fulfilled in the destruction of the temple and Jerusalem in 70 AD.
Okay.
And the events that led up to that. And yes, it's controversial. A lot of people are going to say, what? But what about this? What about that? You know, we're not going to be able to talk about everything, right? But if I can if I come at things from the big picture down, so I step back and say, well, first of all, you know, 23 and 24, I think it really actually starts earlier in chapter 22, the discourse, right?
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, 23 is the setup where Jesus is talking about the guilt of the Jewish leaders in particular, but also those who followed them, that generation, you know, the generation he was speaking to, he talks about them being condemned because they're going to reject Messiah.
Yeah.
And then at the very end of 23, he says, you know, so your house is going to be left desolate because of this, because you're guilty of all the blood of all the previous prophets that were murdered,
right?
And the blood of Messiah. And so it's a... And then there's this bookend. There's these bookends that occur in like 24, in the very beginning of 24 and the very end of 24, where he says all these things will occur to this generation. All these things will happen to this generation. This generation will not pass away
until
things take place. Well, there's been a lot of different ways of interpreting that. And by the way, I was raised on Hal Lindsey in the 70s. I came from that paradigm. But basically, you know, when I studied what that means when Jesus is talking about this generation throughout everywhere in the New Testament and particularly the Gospels, whenever he's saying this generation, not only is he referring to the people he's talking to, literally this generation, but they're almost all the statements are condemnation statements, you know, like, truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away. But then there's multiple places. Let's see if I can find it.
Wicked and perverse generation and kinds of epithets like that. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So those are the statements that lend me to believe that, okay, whatever you believe is between those bookmarks of, you know, these things will happen to this generation and blah, 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 blah. And then he reaffirms it at the end. All these things will take place within this generation. Then that's to me is a dominant paradigm for how am I going to, what are all these wild things that he's saying? How am I supposed to interpret those, right? Because what does abomination of desolation mean, right? Some of it's, you know, more obvious historical stuff. Some of it's more symbolic. What does it mean to come on the clouds? Whatever you have to interpret it, rather than coming at it with our own personal view of, well, this is what it has to be, I'll have to say, well, okay, I should interpret all those things that happen between those phrases as occurring within that generation, which is about 40 years. And that's, you know, that's common, mm-hmm. common understanding. And that to me is the big picture that makes me go, okay, now let me look at these things and see, okay, is there reason to believe that they did take place within that generation? And a generation within 40 years was about 70 AD, yeah. which ended in the destruction of the temple. So as a matter of historical fact, it does fit very well with the paradigm. And this is why scholars over the years have struggled over it. In fact, some of them will believe half of Matthew 24 was fulfilled in the destruction of the temple, because it's very clear. Jesus walks around and says, they say, isn't this great temple, in the beginning of chapter 24? And he says, truly I say to you, not one stone will be left upon another. And many scholars admit, yeah, that has to do with the destruction in 70 AD.
Right.
But then halfway through they say, but there's a change and now it jumps into the future. So there's scholars are recognizing that, I think, that there is there's a need to understand at least some of Matthew 24 related to that ancient time period. Mm.
So what, under a partial preterist view, is still to be fulfilled? What is still ahead of us?
Well, the partial preterist believes, first of all, let's jump ahead to the end, because really, I can prove to you very easily from historical sources, false Christs in the first century,
sure.
wars and rumors of war, famines and earthquake. That's kind of easy, actually.
Yeah.
The thing that for me was the kicker was like, but I'm never going to believe that Jesus came on the clouds, because that has to be the second coming, right?
Right, right.
And for me, that was really the transforming point was studying what it means to come on the clouds in the Bible. And there is corollary in other ancient literature, but you don't even have to look in other ancient literature to find the meaning of what it means to come on the clouds. And when you look all throughout the Old Testament, there's multiple times, and I do in the book, I do record where all these passages are. And, basically it has to do with, this is not a denial of the second coming of Christ. What it is, it's saying, if you look in the Old Testament, it says over and over again, when God judges a city, when he judges Jerusalem in the past, when he judges Egypt, when he judges Assyria, it talks about him coming on the clouds. He rides the clouds. The clouds are his chariot. And this is a very common phrase in the Bible and in the ancient world that had to do with, number one, deity, because it was deities that came on the cloud. The storm god came on the clouds.
Right.
But also, if you look everywhere it talks about cloud comings in the Old Testament, it's always judgment upon cities or nations.
Hmm.
And it says God's coming to Egypt. Well, did God literally come? Was it the second coming of Yahweh? No. It's saying spiritually God was judging the nation through these godless nations that he was sending upon them. But God was – so in other words, this is this notion – behind the earthly wars and battles is spiritual powers. And in this case, in the case of the Old Testament, whether it's Egypt, Assyria, or Jerusalem, in the Old Testament, it's God saying, I am behind the Assyrians who are punishing you in Isaiah 10. I am chastising you, Israel, or whatever, or I'm judging you, Egypt. And so God spiritually comes many times in the Old Testament. Therefore, when you see Jesus saying coming on the clouds, and you can see that there was a judgment on Jerusalem in 70 AD, et cetera, then we see that, we partial preterists see that not as the second coming of Christ. It's a coming of Christ, but it's a cloud coming or a judgment coming.
Mm.
So the point is that from our perspective, a partial preterist, by the way, there are other passages that some would argue, and there's disagreements all about this as well, but some would argue that that doesn't negate a second coming of Christ. There will still be a physical return of Christ, a physical resurrection, and a final judgment. But as I would put it, it just because this one passage doesn't mean there's no, it's replied to the second coming, doesn't mean there aren't other passages.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how partial preterists argue.
So kind of an already but not yet fulfillment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
and I was trying to find a passage in Matthew 25 here that talked about the Son of Man coming in his glory with all the angels with him, but that does refer to the final judgment. It's not a referral to the second coming where he collects the believers to him. So,
yes, there are. Now, yeah. Interestingly, there are disagreements about that, which I'm not going to go into because
surprise.
Of course. There are many partial predators who would say that there is a change, there's a difference there, and that's referencing the final judgment there. But there are also others who I actually tend towards that would argue, no, if you look at those passages, whether it's the sheep and the goats or whatever, it's still a symbolic reference to a judgment or what's going on. But again, yeah, you're right. That basically most partial predators do believe that those later parables have to do with the second coming. Mm.
So as we're getting short on time here, I just want to ask, I guess the cleanup question here. The significance of this. I mean, why does it matter whether we view these passages if there's already but not yet? Why does it matter whether we view the prophecies contained in Matthew 23, 24, 25, and elsewhere in the New Testament as already fulfilled or as not yet fulfilled? How does that affect our walk as Christians?
Very excellent question. In fact, that's what I think is the most important question of all. Because number one, just because a preterist believes that most of the prophecies were fulfilled and there's not going to be a future Antichrist and beast, like most people think, doesn't mean we don't believe there's evil, great evil in the world. Doesn't mean, you know, there can still be evil that we have to fight. And you know, transhumanism is evil and globalism and world dictatorship is bad and we want to fight against it with you. So there's that side of the equation. But also, for me personally, what it was this. Understanding the preteristic fulfillment of a lot of these passages, whether it's Matthew 24 or even the book of Revelation, which is mostly about the first century, I would argue. It has to do with, for me, it was an appreciation and an in-depth, when you discover truth that is beautiful, that is transforming, that is opens your mind, I think that that's what this does. What it did for me personally was it helped me to see a beautiful expanded understanding of the covenant, the new covenant, which is what we are, right? And the whole essence of it is that God was establishing the new covenant in Christ, in Messiah, that he promised all throughout the Old Testament. But what does it mean? What does that covenant really mean? And what does it involve? And when you see when Christ died, he died for our sins and he brought the new covenant. Yeah, there's a spiritual reality to that going on. But what I see also throughout the whole Bible is God doesn't just do things spiritually. He does it historically as well. And so when you understand that what Christ accomplished on the cross was the beauty of the new covenant breaking into history, breaking in and providing the way and a transformation. The old covenant is old. The new covenant is new. But what does that mean? And then how did God finalize that? Because think about it. If you just come and say, there's a new covenant, some guy dies on a tree. Trust me. The old covenant's no longer relevant. You don't have to sacrifice animals. Trust me. Well, yeah, he did some miracles, but really, you're going to abolish everything? We've got this huge temple, which has been the heart and soul of God's people for, you know, millennia.
Yeah.
And you're just saying it's no longer relevant? Well, and secondly, the other main element is, you know, this whole notion of punishing that generation who rejected Messiah. Think about it. What's the greatest sin in history? The greatest evil in all of history would be, in my opinion, murdering Messiah. And so those people who did, God proved that they were wrong, proved that they were evil, proved that they, you know, that Messiah was on his throne by demolishing the physical elements of that old covenant, in my opinion, permanently. But nevertheless, even if they were rebuilt again, I would call it a carcass of a dead religion. But my point is that so God historically consummates what he did spiritually on the cross. Because he's a historical God, so he destroys the elements of the old covenant, and he finalizes that in such a way that it's interesting that that was the very thing that then pushed the Christians to, you know, bring the gospel out to the rest of the world. But You know, so there's that, there's understanding how the physical, historical fulfillment of all the symbolism of the new covenant gets tangibly worked out in history. I mean, that's, I don't know, that's the best way I could put it off the top of my head.
No, well, well put. You know, Psalm 82 says there is a day coming, and you can make a case that it began at the cross, at, on the resurrection, where arise, O God, and judge the earth, for you shall inherit the nations. The sons of God, the 70 sons of God that he placed over the nations after the Tower of Babel, had just had their rights to those 70 nations revoked. They're still active in the world today. I don't think it's a coincidence that at the recent conference back in January, where nations of the world gathered to talk about how Israel was going to be made to split the land and give some to Palestine and the Palestinian Authority, that there were 70 nations represented. I don't think that's a coincidence.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There are also 70 space agencies around the world. I'm not sure what that has to do with anything, but it's an interesting coincidence. But, well, I'm predicting we'll see some emails on this one. Carcass of a Dead Religion. That's Brian Gadawa. Email at gadawa.com. But you make a good point. I mean, the book of Hebrews makes it very clear. And while I have a great deal of respect for some of the folks who are still adhering to some of the physical aspects of that, I think the New Testament is very clear, and you can only interpret it otherwise by taking it out of context. But
Peg, let me address this if I can, because anti-Semitism is often claimed against my viewpoint, and I have no problem admitting that I get accused of that sometimes. It's completely ridiculous. It's completely false. And, you know, for the record, I actually fully support Israel to survive as a nation. And but I do so politically and morally, but right. I don't believe that it has a spiritual, scriptural basis to it anymore.
No, and in my I was going to say in my new book, I actually make the case that the Messiah that they're looking for is going to be the Antichrist. So.
Oh, OK. Yeah. Right. So my point is that and the other thing is this viewpoint does not say all Jews are evil and Christ killers. That's the opposite, actually. It says what the apostles said. And you can find a dozen passages where the apostles said, you guys crucified Messiah, you guys, that generation. Now we're back to that generation. If you understand, it's all about that generation. They were the ones who rejected Messiah. They were the ones that God was judging. And if it's anti-Semitic to say that, then you're saying Jesus was anti-Semitic. Paul was anti-Semitic because they all said that.
Yeah.
And so, but of course not. In fact, you would have to say that the prophets are anti-Semitic because they judged Israel and they said, you're a whore. You have sex with other gods. God's going to judge you and cut you off. He's going to divorce you, right? So this is what the prophets have always said, but it has to do specifically with those people who did that. But once the new covenant comes in, there comes a point at which, as a Christian, you have to acknowledge that the new covenant has arrived, and it replaces the old covenant. So however you're going to deal with that theological aspect, whatever respect you do have for Israel has to, in my opinion, no matter what view you have, has to be tempered by the fact that the New Testament says the church is his people. Mm-hmm. We are the body of Christ, you know what I mean? And so that's, you know, like I said, even though I have that belief, I think we should invade Iran, man. I'm on the far right in terms of being with Israel, because they are our only democratic ally in that Middle East, surrounded by demonic evil, Muslim evil. So,
right.
You're not going to get me you're not going to be able to accuse me of being anti-Semitic. You know,
well, I'm not sure about invading Iran, but I do agree with your characterization of the nations around Israel. It's certainly they're in a bad neighborhood, and the enemy.
I am being hyperbolic, but I definitely think that we need to be aggressive about protecting our democratic ally over there. Let me put it that way, because what has occurred in the last 8 years has just been abominable, you know,
and abominable. So. Hat tip to Jerome Corsi for that one. Brian Gadawa's website is gadawa.com. The new novel, book one of the Chronicles of the Apocalypse, Tyrant, Rise of the Beast. read about Nero, the watcher called Apollyon, and the actions of apostles, or the apostles in action, if you were, John, who's nicknamed Thunderhead by Apollyon. And Brian's typical style, very visual when you read it, like you're reading and seeing a movie in your head, which makes sense because he is a scriptwriter, a screenwriter by trade. Brian, thanks a lot for your time today. We really appreciate it. Look forward to seeing you again, whether it's by Skype or eventually one of these days we're going to have to do this face-to-face. Appreciate your continued work and research, and encourage people not only to get the novel but also take advantage of his offer of the book on Matthew 24. Understand where he's coming from so that we are not so doctrinal, so tied to a particular view that we miss something in our intellectual pride. And I'm speaking, you know, preaching to myself here. So again, Brian, thanks for your work. Appreciate it. And we'll talk to you again soon. Check the show notes at vftb.net. Or if you're watching this on the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Derek Gilbert, then look below in the notes, below the video, and you'll find a link to Brian's website, Gadawa.com, and also a link to where you can get a copy of the new novel. Full disclosure, I am a futurist when it comes to interpreting end times prophecy. Do believe that we're looking at a pre-tribulation rapture, that the extent of the calamities prophesied in Revelation and by some of the Old Testament prophets are so unique, one of a kind, like nothing ever happened like this before and ain't nothing going to happen like this ever again, argue for a futurist interpretation. But I'm willing to be wrong about this, as long as God has prophesied that there's a good ending coming, I'm okay with that, however it plays out. So this is not one of those things I'm going to divide with a brother in Christ over, regardless of whether we come to a meeting of the minds on this particular topic. And I will say again that even though he's using fiction to express his theological viewpoint here, he is heavily footnoting the novel, and it is worth reading, if only just because it's a way to get educated in an entertaining format. What a concept. Learning while you're actually enjoying what you read. So do check that out. A couple of items in the news this past week. President Trump issued another travel restriction executive order. Of course, another judge, this time in Hawaii, overturned it. The district court judge, the judicial overreach in this particular case is stunning. It is breathtaking. First of all, when the Fifth Circuit Court, or the Ninth Circuit, rather, overturned or ruled against the previous executive order, the question was raised, how is it that a district court has the authority to put a hold on an executive order for all 50 of the United States? So that question still applies to this ruling against, or, you know, this ruling by the district court judge in Hawaii. But even beyond this, the court in Hawaii has basically overturned 200 plus years, because I guess the Constitution didn't go into effect until the 1790s, but over 200 years of judicial precedent, because at no point in the history of the United States until last week did a judge ever argue that people who are not citizens of the United States and not present in the United States were covered by the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. This judge is ruling that the United States Constitution essentially applies to anybody, anywhere, at any time. The only qualification is that you have to have a university here who wanted to assert, quote unquote, the foreigner's rights, or you had some physical person present in the U.S. who wanted you here. In this case, it was a Muslim imam in Hawaii who had relatives who are not citizens of the United States that he wants to bring here. And so the judge argues that these people have a constitutional right because they are covered by the Constitution because of this imam in Hawaii. It is insane, frankly. And I suggest that President Trump go full Andrew Jackson, and this is the suggestion of a Fox News commentator, Robert Barnes. So not original to me, but Robert Barnes is suggesting that President Trump would be within his rights as the president to go full out Andrew Jackson on this judge. Jackson, of course, when he was
asked about a Supreme Court ruling that he disagreed with, he said, well, the court has made its ruling. Now it can enforce it. We'll see what happens. An assemblyman, that's a state legislator in the state of New York, has proposed a bill that would require people or, well, any online source of information to remove information that is deemed inaccurate, irrelevant, inadequate, or excessive when referring to other people. In other words, if you post something to the internet that I don't like, I could demand that it be removed because it was inaccurate, irrelevant, excessive, or so forth. And you would have to take it down within 30 days, assuming a court sided with me in this matter. And if it were not removed within 30 days, you could be fined up to $250 a day per incident. This is essentially a bill to suppress non-government approved free speech. Now, we'll see what happens in the state of New York legislature with this, but it's amazing that there are people serving in government, elected officials, who think that somehow the government has a right to determine what is and what is not relevant, accurate, and adequate information about other parties, from one party to another. It is, you know, one more chip in the block or in the wall that is separating us Americans from full-out tyranny. So we will see where that goes. A couple of news notes from around the world regarding health. H7N9 avian flu has been confirmed in Tennessee. It is pathogenic for the chickens and turkeys involved. It has not yet spread to humans, unlike the H7N9 strain that has turned up in China. But officials in Tennessee and Alabama are watching that pretty closely. In Vietnam, January saw 6,500 cases of dengue fever. That is a very painful disease. It's not always, not usually fatal, but it's extremely painful, like chikungunya. And that is a 50% increase year over year. Nope, take that back. It's 50% decrease in January 2017 compared to last year, but still 6,500 cases. That's nothing to sneeze at, pardon the pun. And in the Republic of Congo, Central Africa, an outbreak of monkeypox is affecting people there. And this one is pretty lethal. 19 reported cases so far, 7 dead. That is, 38% mortality rate? Now, again, 19 people doesn't sound a lot, but that mortality rate is something to be aware of and concerned about, because the Spanish flu of 1918 and 1919 that killed between 20 and 50 million people was estimated at only between 2.5% and 5% mortality. So just something to be aware of. Coming up on A View from the Bunker, we've got a number of interesting discussions. Next week, we'll present another discussion with our good friends Doug Woodward and new friend Anthony Patch. They've got a new DVD out. This is sort of a quick follow-up to their book, which they collaborated with Josh Peck and Gans Shimura, called Revising Reality. This is CERN Decoded. Fascinating stuff. If you thought that the previous discussion with Doug, Anthony, Gans, and Josh was interesting, this should be right up your alley then, because we focus just on CERN, the Large Hadron Collider, and what those who are running the thing are hoping to accomplish with it. Startling stuff. On April 2nd, we will be taking that weekend off. That's the weekend of the Hear the Watchman conference. We'll tell you more about that in just a couple of minutes. It is sold out now, by the way, but the live stream option is still available. April 9th, L.A. Marzulli and the Watchman Chronicles, his new DVD set, interviews with eyewitnesses to unidentified flying objects and other things that don't seem to have a natural explanation. And then on April 16th, a new guest to A View from the Bunker, a gentleman who's collaborating with our friends Brian Gadawa and Mike Heiser on the Paranormal podcast, along with Natalina. Doug Van Dorn put out a book about 3 years ago titled Giants, Sons of the Gods. Happened to be reading it. He sent me a note through the through Facebook just the other day about a shorter interview I did with Brian on Skywatch TV recently. So having made that connection, it seemed silly not to ask Doug if he'd like to talk about his book and about the object, the subject of his book, Giants, and why things like the Nephilim, the Anakim, and Goliath and his brothers are even mentioned in the Bible at all. If giants aren't significant, not important, why did God inspire the prophets and the apostles to mention them at all in the Bible? So that'll be coming up on April the 16th. Hear the Watchman Conference. It is sold out, but you can still participate by live video stream. That option is still available. It's $39. All of the sessions will be streamed live to the internet and then archived for 30 days afterward, so that if you miss something or you want to watch something again, you've got a month to do it. But be advised that the price of the live stream goes up after the 22nd of March, which is coming up when? I had the calendar open and I just closed it. The 22nd is Wednesday. So after Wednesday of this week, the price goes up from $39 to $49. So take advantage of it now and save an extra 5% by using the promo code Gilbert5. That's Gilbert and the numeral 5 at checkout. And you can sign up for the live stream at hearthewatchman.com or click the link in the show notes below. Well worth it to see guys like L.A. Marzulli, Russ Dizdar, Pastor Carl Gallups, Pastor Billy Crone, Pastor Mike Spaulding, Pastor Paul Begley, John B. Wells, all in one place and at one time. Josh Peck, Sharon, and myself will be there from Skywatch TV. And again, if you won't be in Dallas, we hope you can take advantage of the live streaming option. The True Legends Conference, just announced a week ago, coming to Branson. That's our backyard here in the Ozarks, and so we're looking forward to that. That will be at the Mansion Theater in Branson, September 15th through the 17th of this year. Listen to this lineup. Tom Horn, who's not speaking at conferences anymore, but he agreed to do this one because he owes Steve Quayle a favor. Steve Quayle, Timothy Alberino, again, L.A. Marzulli, Dr. Michael Lake, Pastor David Lankford, and me. Also, a Spanish explorer and the founder of an explorer's club that actually found a network of tunnels in Bolivia that were featured in the last True Legends documentary, Anselm P. Rambla. So you'll get to hear from him directly. Again, this is in a great theater, great seats, better than what we normally get at a conference because this is set up for music theater. The Oak Ridge Boys will be playing at the Mansion Theater the week after this conference, give you an idea of the type of performers that will play there. The registration and information is available online at gen6conferences.com. That's G-E-N-S-I-X conferences.com. And then, of course, in October, we'll be at the Blessed Hope Prophecy Forum. That's with our friends Prophecy Watchers, Bob Ulrich and Gary Stearman, October 13th through the 15th. That's at the Embassy Suites Hotel in Norman, Oklahoma. For more information on that, log on to prophecywatchers.com. Because of, well, we're taking a mini vacation next weekend, and the following weekend is the conference in Dallas. The Gilbert House Fellowship, our weekly Bible study, is taking a two-week hiatus because we're just not going to be around for a couple of weeks. So we appreciate your patience. We're getting into the good stuff in the New Testament, the book of Revelation. We just opened the six seals today, you may have noticed. But we'll be back in 3 weeks with an hour of study in the Old Testament, hour of study in the New Testament, and all of those archives going back to Genesis 1:1 are archived at gilberthouse.org. Please leave us a review at iTunes or Stitcher or wherever else fine podcasts are sold. And please weigh in with your opinions at facebook.com/viewfromthebunker, which is a production of Gilbert House, released under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives, 4.0 international license. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. The opening introduction by DC Good. I'm Derek Gilbert. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. This is A View from the Bunker.